Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Errol Yabuke.
And Errol, we'll talk today about some things that are not complicated, like how awful the generals are in Sudan, or how awful the wannabe generals like Steve Bannon are in the United States.
And we'll also talk about things that are slightly more complicated. This week, we lost former Secretary of State Colin Powell. So Colin Powell's legacy might be construed as being a little bit complicated. And on that list is literally everything in Nigeria.
Yeah, a lot of complicated things happening there, which we'll definitely break down. But this is a good, deep conversation about a lot of different things happening in the world. And I'm excited about it.
I loved your rabbit holes. we need more Mike rabbit holes. And I think this is a really good one on Nigeria. I hope everyone enjoys listening.
Awesome. Let's do it. Welcome, everyone. Hey, Errol.
Hey, Mike. Good to see you on a Tuesday afternoon.
Good to see you, too. We've got some afternoon brews going today.
Some afternoon brews. I have to say that mine is not of the alcoholic variety, in part because I finally read the fine print on some of my medicine that I'm taking for my Achilles.
No.
Turns out one should not consume alcohol while taking certain types of medication.
This is why I've stopped reading.
Or maybe, you know, one should, but out of an abundance of caution, on Tuesday afternoon, I have decided, since I do have kid responsibilities after the recording of this, I've decided to go with, we did get a soda stream recently.
Ooh,
and so it seemed a little ridiculous that we had a line item in our budget for Topo Chico. So we just use, like, you know, 4 days worth of that budget to actually buy a soda stream. And so it's good. It's not as good as Topo Chico, but it does the trick. And I went ahead and put it in a Gatorade bottle because apparently I'm like an NFL player and I need to be able to put it in my mouth in a squeezy bottle. But, you know.
Yeah, very, very Dan's Cafe for the DC listeners. How is the Achilles doing?
It's getting there. It's getting there. I started walking this week in a boot, but I think, you know, hopefully we'll burn the crutches relatively soon. Yeah, moving in the right direction. The goal is we're taking an international trip over the holidays, and the goal is that I can walk through the airport avec bébés while we're doing that. Although a friend pointed out, like, well, that's a missed opportunity because if you have a boot on or something, you can just ride in all those little carts.
That's true.
Which I've always wanted to do.
Yeah, maybe just alter those goals. So important to be nimble, you know?
Yeah, it's like, is that fun worth taking crutches? I think the answer is no.
Yeah. But, well, I am not on any sort of Achilles medication, so I do have an afternoon brew. I am
jealous.
Elysian Superfuzz Blood Orange Pale. I obtained as part of a multi-pack of other Elysian beers, which is a really cool brewery out of Seattle. And the Superfuzz Blood Orange Pale was the one that nobody wanted to touch. So I now have just a set of these in my refrigerator. And I've got to say, number one, the label is super cool. Almost like a kind of Jimi Hendrix inspired icon on it.
I like that.
Two, it's actually quite delicious. The blood orange, very subtle. The pale, very forward. So I appreciate that. And I'm enjoying this one.
I'm down for a good fruity beer as long as it's not too fruity. Blood orange.
More than anything, it's like the can has been sort of rimmed with orange peel is almost like the hint that I get. It's really nice.
Ooh, maybe like on the rim of the can, just like put some cinnamon on there.
Mm, I like it. That's a post podcast recording move, I think.
You heard it here, folks.
All right. Should we jump into the first round?
Let's do it.
All right. We will start in Barbados.
I don't think we've started in Barbados. I don't think we've gone to Barbados at all.
This is, I think, yeah, our first News and Brews trip to Barbados. Foreshadowing for a real trip? Maybe.
Yeah, I was just about to say the same thing. Like, what if we recorded a News and Brews in Barbados? That would be, we should just make that happen.
Barbados has elected its first ever president, current Governor General Sandra Mason. When she's sworn in on November 30th, she will officially replace Queen Elizabeth as the Barbadian head of state, 55 years exactly after the country gained independence from Britain. And we at News and Brews would just like to officially welcome Barbados to Team Meghan and to let Canada know there's still plenty of room over here.
Congratulations to Barbados. Does this mean they're still going to be part of the Commonwealth? Do you know?
I don't know.
Like, can one be part of the... I'm watching The Crown, so I'm an expert in all things British history. I don't know, actually, if one can technically be part of the Commonwealth, though, if Queen Elizabeth is not the head of state.
Right. Is that, like, definitional?
I think we should continue talking about this, even though we have no idea what we're talking about.
that's another News and Brews theme.
Well, I think from one... very good example of functioning democracy to perhaps an example of a democracy that is certainly in fear of not working. Let's go to Sudan.
That, folks, is called a smooth transition.
Yeah, thanks. And you know what is not a smooth transition has been Sudan's transition to democracy. I'm laughing at the transition. I'm not laughing about what's going on in Sudan right now, for the record, because... basically, on Monday or yesterday, we're recording on Tuesday, Sudan's military overthrew the civilian government that's been in place since a popular uprising in 2019. That uprising overthrew longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir, famous for his perpetration of genocide in Darfur and being, you know, housing Osama bin Laden, providing him safe haven, and just being an all-around not very nice person.
Yeah, we'll talk about complicated legacies in our next segment. Omar al-Bashir, not a complicated legacy.
Not a complicated legacy. Nice foreshadowing. Agreed. Not a complicated legacy. The man should probably be in some sort of Hague trial or something for what he's done. That having been said, it was a really neat moment for democracy in 2019. And I'm not a Sudan watcher. I lived in South Sudan, and so I kind of keep it in the back of my radar. But you know, when there were these popular uprisings in 2019, all of us were like really scared at first, like, oh, is this going to mean the military-backed government is going to, you know, kill a bunch of protesters and really crack down? And the reality was back then that it didn't happen. And what happened was that they put in this transitional government that basically said the military is still going to maintain some power as part of this, you know, so-called sovereign council. They were going to be the chair of that, but that over time there would be this transition. And so the prime minister was civilian starting in 2019. And then, you know, over time it would transition to be fully civilian as of, you know, this year. That sort of gets at a little bit of like, why is this happening now? And so what happened is essentially that the military overthrew the government and put the prime minister in jail and arrested a whole bunch of other people and basically said, we're in charge now. Don't worry, there's going to be elections in 2023, but we're going to like reimpose order or whatever the language is that they used. And so immediately people went out onto the streets. And again, there were fear of reprisals. And like, this is a very much like a developing story just within like the past hours.
The idea was that they would shift over to civilian control now in advance of elections in a couple of years, right?
That's what they said.
And then the military component of this council has basically, via a coup, nixed that incremental transition.
Exactly. So in November, so next month, basically the military was on schedule to cede their control of that sovereign council and effectively lose their hold on Sudan. They're worried about this, not just from like power hunger, is that a word? But they're worried about this because they control a bunch of industry. Like over time under Bashir, the military consolidated a bunch of the industries in Sudan. And so they're making tons and tons of money through the companies that they control. That's very corrupt. That could theoretically come to an end. And I think perhaps more fear-inducing for them is this idea that they could maybe be held accountable for past crimes. Omar Bashir was very much the head perpetrator, but he was not the only perpetrator of things like genocide in Darfur. And there, you know, a lot of the folks that worked with him are still in and around government. And I think there's a fear that if they cede that control, that they could be held accountable.
Yeah. And as of Tuesday afternoon, when we're recording this, it looks like the top general in Sudan is detaining the civilian prime minister at his own home, at the general's home. And there are pretty large scale protests in the streets, as well as businesses closing and acts of civil disobedience. So absolutely a fluid and developing, but potentially very, very scary story.
Yeah, my friend Dan Schneiderman has an excellent tweet thread on this. We'll link it in the show notes that talks about not only some of the stuff that we talked about in terms of what's going on, but kind of the implications. And I think more importantly, what the international community can do to respond to this, which is not a whole lot, but also something.
Yep, yep. On from complicated present to the complicated legacy.
Yeah, as listeners, I'm sure undoubtedly know, Colin Powell passed away this year. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell, his family said that he died of COVID-19 complications. He also had some other health issues, Parkinson's and a form of cancer, but he was 84, you know, relatively young man and in today's terms. And so it was a really sad day for those of us in the kind of foreign policy, national security space. Just to cut to the chase, it's complicated by his own admission. His legacy is complicated by his own admission because of Iraq, but I'll get there in a second. I remember actually, I was at the University of Texas and I used to be a resident assistant because I'm super cool like that. And so I was like sitting in the dorm. I remember this very, I don't know why I remember this so vividly, but I was in the front of San Jacinto dorm, like at the desk late at night or whenever it was, you know, people coming in and out, whatever. And there was a TV in the corner. And I remember seeing like the UN, and it turns out it was probably the UN Security Council. And I remember Colin Powell giving this speech to the United Nations, basically proving with all sorts of maps and data and the certainty and the credibility that only Colin Powell could provide, that there was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And it was sort of the justification for intervention. And I remember thinking at that point, like, okay, this makes sense. Like, that's really bad. Saddam's bad. The fact that he has weapons of mass destruction is really bad. We should do something about that, not just for our own national security, but like for the Iraqi people, and for, you know, Israel and the region. Like, Saddam Hussein should not have weapons of mass destruction. And the fact that turned out to be wrong is he called it a blot on his record. I'd welcome your thoughts on his legacy. I mean, I don't think that it overshadows the entirety of his legacy. This is a man who was the first Black national security advisor under Reagan. He was the first Black Secretary of State. He was in the military. If he had run for president, I think he was largely considered to be an incredibly viable candidate for president on the Republican side. And I think more importantly, he was just really well respected by everyone. I mean, certainly, you know, I didn't get into this business because of Colin Powell, but I think, like, you know, seeing people like him who are kind of public servants to the end. He was very critical of Trump in a lot of ways. He was very critical of January 6th. I think like it harkens back maybe to a different time in our politics and foreign policy where, you know, he and I come from different political persuasions perhaps, but I'm going to miss him.
Yeah. I think he more than anyone else probably was emblematic of the post-Cold War unipolar moment for America, winning the first Gulf War in very short order, at least militarily, yeah, you know, having the credibility and sort of seeing the U.S.'s place in the world in that moment gave him the stature that was really unmatched for a while there. And you know, I think he flirted with a presidential run in 1996. And then in 2000, he was for a long time, the most popular public figure in America. And then ultimately he, or, you know, Bush and Cheney used that stature to sell a bill of goods to the people of this country and the world. I do think it's really, and you've seen some sentiment from the online left, you know, about him being a war criminal and having nothing redeeming and really kind of negative reaction to this news. I do think it's really meaningful that he acknowledged how bad that was, the Iraq lead up. I think he did that both internally in the moment, in an oversight capacity, you know, speaking to some of the commissions that were investigating the run up to the Iraq war, and then afterwards as well. You know, he endorsed Obama fairly early. He spoke out against Trump. He spoke out against the shift in the dynamics of his own Republican Party. And I think that that is really important and should be considered as part of his legacy as well.
100%.
I don't think he can be remembered in that sort of unalloyed heroic light that he may have once had, you know, back when Rudy Giuliani was America's mayor. But certainly should be remembered as a man of integrity and a true servant, a public servant in America, and an example of someone worth learning from.
I don't know if you've listened to Slate has this podcast called Slow Burn, and they've had multiple seasons of it. The first season was on Nixon impeachment, and they went through Clinton impeachment, et cetera. And their latest season was actually on the run up to Iraq. They also did a Tupac Biggie season, which was really phenomenal. Yeah, it was really good. But this latest one was about the run-up to the Iraq war. And I think it portrayed Colin Powell as someone who had misgivings, but then ultimately was asked to do something by, you know, his superiors. And he did it. And he did it convincingly. He did it well. He did it like as he was asked to do. And so I would agree with you, his sort of willingness to admit fault, and, you know, that shouldn't be underestimated. I mean, that's really hard for people in this town to do. It's certainly admirable. One last thing on him, two last things. One is that he was pretty instrumental in the Balkans and during the 90s, you know, the gripe against the United
States.
Meaning
like Kosovo and
right, right. Okay. You know, perhaps we could have intervened sooner, but he was part of that, I believe. And then I do know for sure he did also, speaking of Sudan, he did go to Darfur while he was Secretary of State and called attention to what was going on there, and kind of is seen as this kind of military general turned statesman. But he did do a lot at the same time for sort of humanitarian causes, and he was a strong believer in human rights and things. So it's slightly unfair to say it was a complicated legacy. I think he made a big mistake, and I think he acknowledged that big mistake, and that big mistake had serious consequences that should not be undervalued. But at the same time, I don't think that necessarily creates a clouded legacy. I think this was a public servant that deserves lots of recognition.
Yep. Yep.
You know who doesn't deserve recognition?
Who doesn't deserve recognition?
Steve Bannon.
Well, he got a form of recognition, didn't he? This
week. He did. Last week, the House voted to hold Steve Bannon in contempt for defying a January 6th related subpoena, which of course he defied the subpoena because of course he was complicit in everything that was going on January 6th.
I mean, more than complicit, I think it's becoming clear that he had a really prominent planning role in January 6th. He tried to circumvent the subpoena by claiming executive privilege through Trump's lawyers, which for someone who hasn't served in government for over 3 years by the time the events in question took place, makes zero sense. It also came out earlier this week, I think there was an article in Rolling Stone, that basically the organizers of the January 6th rallies had a series of meetings with people like Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows, but also with members of Congress about this rally that ultimately led to the storming of the Capitol, several deaths, you know, setting up of a gallows on the National Mall, et cetera.
Were these like visitors? Were they calling them like visitors and tourists or something?
Not quite. I think it There was one detail in the story that jumped out at me, which was that Representative Paul Gosar, who I think is from Arizona, essentially promised the organizers a blanket pardon from President Trump for anything that they would do on January 6th. I think it just shows that there's a lot more that we have to learn about this story. And hopefully that this committee will be allowed to do its job in investigating and bringing this to light and creating some transparency and helping ensure that something like this can't happen again.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge is that basically an entire political party doesn't want to talk about this at all and understand how it represents the shortcomings in our own democracy. And because the committee is, or the commission or whatever is overwhelmingly Democratic, I think it, whatever they find will be painted as being partisan. So yeah, Steve Bannon, really not a good guy. I did have a point on Rolling Stone. When I think of like media, I don't think of Rolling Stone, but then every once in a while, Rolling Stone comes out with like a humdinger.
Yeah.
Like this, like they're the ones that broke the Petraeus story ultimately. And that led to his downfall in Afghanistan and this. And I'm sure there's other examples over the years, but kudos to Rolling Stone for doing the investigation.
Yeah, good on you. We haven't talked about the episode in Turkey over the last week, this diplomatic spat, where a group of Western nations, including led by really the Biden administration, called on President Erdogan to release an activist from prison. And there was a lot of huffing and puffing in response. I didn't realize that there was an official designation of declaring someone persona non grata, but that's really cool. In and of it, yeah, aside from any of the real dynamics of what's happening here, ultimately they found a diplomatic solution, back down. Yeah, he had threatened to essentially expel all of these 10 ambassadors from like the US and many other allied countries, which could have put a rift into NATO. They ended up backing down. But do you have any takes on what happened there?
Yeah, this is how it's supposed to work. This is what I think the Obama administration should have done a long time ago. I think that there was this, during the Obama administration, there was this reticence to ostracize Turkey with the belief that like being friendly with it and kind of looking the other way as Erdogan had creeping authoritarian tendencies would somehow keep him on the team. And I think it has come out, many of us feared at the time, and I think it's come out since, that he sort of played us in that way and kind of use this carrot of alignment with the West as a way of consolidating power, which he has essentially done. The Trump administration's approach was always, of course, do everything bilaterally and do everything through tweet and bluster. And oh, by the way, Trump and Erdogan have similar authoritarian tendencies. Mm-hmm. And so there was sort of more natural alignment. So again, not super useful to analyze that. And fast forward to now, Erdogan has not just creeping authoritarian tendencies, but you know, has had, you know, some pretty stark examples of this over his last 2 decades of reign in Turkey. As an aside, quickly, like his hold on power is weakening, not only because there are reports that he himself is in ill health, but because the opposition is starting to, the challenge over the last 20 years, not to go too deep in the Turkish politics rabbit hole, but the challenge has been that the opposition is very fractured. Think about like lefty greens and kind of like the right wing of the right wing of the Republican Party, and only united behind the idea that they are secular. And so like, how do you get those people to agree on literally anything else other than opposition to the kind of more religion driven AK party? And I think there are initial signs that may be happening, not the like greens in the far right, but at least those center left and center left parties coming together.
That's so interesting, because that's not unlike what we've seen in Israel, not unlike what we're seeing in Hungary emerge in opposition to in advance of the next election. I think that's a really interesting thread for us to follow, of these political marriages of convenience in opposition to creeping authoritarianism and what comes of that.
Yeah. And the challenge is, of course, turning that into some sort of governing coalition. But I think people in Turkey are so desperate for change that it's sort of like, we'll solve that later. So all of this is a backdrop to answer your question, which is, there are obviously Turkey watchers within all of those various governments that you mentioned that are probably realizing that Erdogan is not in a particularly strong position right now. Also, if they go in with a unified sense, like, it's real easy for Erdogan to kick out one ambassador. It's not that easy for him to kick out 10 ambassadors. And so this sort of like multilateral approach to being a check on Erdogan and his sort of creeping, if not risen, authoritarianism is the way that this should work. Hmm.
Excellent. I learned a lot from that answer. Last quick note for our first round here. Later this week, I think it's Thursday of this week, we'll be getting GDP numbers. So, you know, the official report on GDP growth for Q3 in the US. Expectations are that growth will be much lower than it has been the last couple of quarters, largely as a result of the Delta variant's emergence in July. The expectation is that GDP growth will come in at around 1.4% annualized. It could well be lower, actually, depending on where inventories stand. If inventories get depleted, that contributes negatively to GDP, the GDP calculation. And as we know, supply chains are quite strained at the moment, as we've talked about. So I want to seed that for listeners, whether you're listening to this before or after Thursday of this week, and just call out that the news media can sometimes get caught up in a narrative and a data point here and there and kind of shift things to a negative tone. And just to call out that before we see any of these numbers, expectations are lower for this GDP growth report. And as we are now getting past the surge in cases from the Delta variant, we expect that looking out over Q4 and into 2022, that we'll see growth pick up again.
Is the coverage about this usually about what the actual numbers are versus the expectations, or the fact, like, if expectations are 1.4% and we come in at 1.4%, will that be a story? Or is it, if they come in at 1.4, but it's actually 0.4, then that's the story.
So the coverage is typically all over the map, right? You'll have Fox News covering 1.4% like they want to.
As being low, and that's like Biden's the worst.
Exactly. Right? And you know, everyone has their level of economic sophistication and their own agenda, if you look across the media. So it's hard, right? One thing to look at is the market's reaction, because the market will have priced in what the expectations are already, right? So if you see GDP growth come in at 2%, you know, that's something that Fox News and OAN will try to spin as a major slowdown, but you also probably see the stock market pick up.
Interesting. And so last question on this, since you're a resident economist here at News & Brews, because you took a couple classes in undergrad. Actually, your degree was in economics.
I was a major in economics. All right.
Okay. You were a major. Classes. So you took a couple classes. Do you expect this, for the reasons that you talked about? There's supply chain issues, there's inventory, there's whatever, the Delta variant kind of, you know, putting our summer of openness back on the rocks. Do you expect some sort of like rebound next quarter, such that, like, fast forward to January when the next report comes out, is it different, or is it too early to tell, too hard to tell?
The early coverage I've seen, so I'm not a practicing economist who is sort of looking at the primary indicators every day and developing my own forecast. The early coverage I've seen is expecting an improvement in Q4, because you'll see case numbers dropping, the economy reopening. You know, we do expect healthy demand around the holiday season, even if there's a question mark around supply and there may be some shipping delays and things like that. Yeah, I think fair to say at this point, based on what I've seen, the expectation is for a rebound starting in Q4.
If I'm the Biden-Harris administration and there's ever going to be a bad quarter, this is probably not the worst quarter to have a bad quarter.
Totally agree. This like exact halfway point between the general and midterm elections is like really the right time to slump.
Yeah. I mean, not to make like everything political, but look, whatever it is, there's going to be bad headlines. And I think your point about like watch the markets is a really cool one. And certainly will improve the way that I follow this story. But I also think like it's probably going to go up next quarter because of Christmas and the holiday sort of buying thing. It's probably going to continue to go up the more people get vaccinated and boosters and things open up. And like we have less of a goods only economy and we like start to open up services again too, and travel and hospitality and stuff like that. So I could see, you know, in their perfect world, things peaking right around November of next year. Mm-hmm. Not to say that that will deliver, you know, wins in what is projected to be a very tough midterm for the Democratic Party. I think it would be even tougher if the economy were bad.
Well, and I think the big question mark remains inflation, right? Yeah, I don't think there are real, even with a lower growth quarter hitting in Q3, I don't think there are real concerns right now about true stagflation of, you know, a prolonged demand slump along with an increase in prices. That being said, inflation is still a big question mark. And I think there were, as we talked about last week, there were a lot of people who thought that the supply chain stickiness or backlog would have cleared itself up by now. That has not happened. We do expect to see that linger for some time. So yeah, it remains to be seen what the status of the economy will be a year from now.
Cool.
All right.
Color me excited for what is to come.
Should we get into our main story?
Yeah, let's do it.
So today we're talking about Nigeria, and let me preface with a caveat that I am by no means an expert observer of Nigeria, Nigerian politics or economy or anything else.
I've been there once, so I'm the world's expert.
Great. So that's infinite percentage more times than I've been there. that being said, there was actually a really great article in The Economist this week, kind of breaking down many parts of the situation in Nigeria right now that caught my eye. I then went down numerous rabbit holes, kind of pulling different threads and just learning more about it, and was really struck by how many of the meta narratives and big picture trends and forces that we talk about again and again as driving events in the world are also both behind some of what we're seeing in Nigeria right now and will be affected by what's happening in Nigeria right now. So I thought this would be a great one to highlight. And you know, you having been there and being an expert would have a lot to add as well.
As a quick aside, I love that we have our own podcast so that we can go down rabbit holes. And one day, if we ever have merch, there needs to be a rabbit hole in one of our, like that needs to be visually represented in one of our like t-shirts or something.
If you're suggesting that we sell magician's hats, I am totally with you. All right. For a little bit of context, Nigeria is a massive country, population over 200 million people, almost double that of any other country in Africa, and also the largest GDP on the continent. A lot of people in the US became aware of some of the security challenges in Nigeria in 2014 with the school kidnappings in Chibok, the hashtag bring back our girls moment, where the militant jihadist group Boko Haram kidnapped 276 female students, actually over 100 of whom I think are still missing and unknown whereabouts.
Yep.
In 2015, so the next year, they had a presidential election and they elected Muhammadu Buhari president. Buhari is a former military dictator, having led a coup and ruled for a few years in the 1980s. By 2015, for that election, he described himself as a quote unquote converted Democrat and was elected over the incumbent president with maybe the best name of any world leader, Good Luck Jonathan. So we were sorry to see him go for that reason. Buhari was elected largely on a pledge to degrade Boko Haram and improve the security situation in the country.
I have to say, on your point about names, the former mayor of Austin's name is Will Wynn.
That was a great one.
Which is strong. For sure. But yes, Good Luck Jonathan. And it's worth pointing out that the transition from Jonathan to Buhari was a peaceful transition of power. And that's not an insignificant point.
For sure. Fast forward to today, and the security situation has markedly not improved and has actually gotten much worse, starting with the jihadist groups. So there was some news very recently that seemed positive. So between August and early October of this year, about 3,600 Boko Haram fighters surrendered. But this is largely due to not to a fear of the central government or the military, but of Islamic State West African Province, a group that broke off from Boko Haram in 2015 and pledged allegiance to ISIS. They go by ISWAP. Or ISWAP.
ISWAP?
No, ISWAP. Anyway, no known affiliation with Cardi B or Megan Thee Stallion that we can tell.
Let's go with ISWAP.
In May of this year, ISWAP cornered Boko Haram's leader, Abu Bakar Shekau, and he detonated a suicide vest. So Boko Haram was basically left leaderless, demoralized, which led to a lot of these surrenders of Boko Haram fighters. But ISWAP is growing, and the security situation in Northeast Nigeria, where these groups are active, has been steadily deteriorating. For what it's worth, 2 weeks ago, the Nigerian military reported that Abu Musab al-Barnawi, the leader of ISWAP, was dead. But they've been known to, let's say, exaggerate the reports of insurgents' deaths in the past, including Shekau of Boko Haram. And it's not totally clear how important Barnawi actually was in the ISWAP power structure. So despite that report, I think the consensus is that ISWAP continues to grow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert in ISWAP, but I don't even know how to pronounce it. But these groups are typically not really that hierarchical and like well-organized from a central. We tend to think about these groups like we think about the Western military. Like you have your battalions and your, you know, commanders of the battalions, and then they report to generals, et cetera, et cetera. And that's not how the Taliban in Afghanistan work, right? Mm-hmm. Like one of the biggest challenges with the Taliban right now is disparate, like they were sort of unified behind a common enemy, and they're like, oh shit, now we're in charge, what do? We actually don't agree on anything else. And so this is kind of what I think you're seeing in Boko Haram. This is what you're seeing in ISIS. It's not that they have all the answers. Some of them may be very well organized at a local level, but as these organizations grow in size, it's not necessarily that they have everything under control.
And I think a really interesting parallel to Afghanistan, where you see there the Taliban and ISIS-K diverging as the Taliban have taken power. And now, you know, their largest internal security threat is attacks from ISIS-K. And in the same way, you know, ISWAP broke off from Boko Haram just 5 years ago, but they are really, you know, not aligned in any way and actually quite antagonistic toward one another, despite sharing some, you know, jihadist motivations.
Yeah. And one of the takeaways here is not the kind of internal machinations of violent extremist groups. I think the main takeaway is like, there's just incredible space for violent extremism to grow and prosper, not only in the Sahel and across the region, but just sort of globally right now. Good governance is not the norm, and there are opportunities for bad actors to fill governance voids from El Salvador to Afghanistan to, you know, Bangladesh. And so, you know, I think it's really important to know who the leaders are of these organizations and what they're kind of what's happening with them and stuff like that. But I think there's also never enough attention on like the sort of space that they have to operate. Like, okay, they're fighting with one another, but like, why are we not fighting with them? Why are we not like, you know, creating, sort of lessening the space for them to grow and prosper?
Great, great point. But here's the thing is jihadists, whether Boko Haram or ISWAP, are not actually the main security threat in Nigeria anymore.
Wah, wah, wah.
And so in the south of the country, you still have some bad memories of a civil war in the late 60s that killed 1 million people. That war was based on a separatist movement in a region called Biafra, home to an ethnic group called the Igbos.
Which, by the way, sorry to interrupt you here, Mike. You said most people sort of think of Nigeria as the hashtag bring back our girls. Our parents' generation actually remembers the Biafran War.
And you now have a serious separatist movement in the south again. So it's led by a group called the Indigenous Peoples of Biafra. Their goal is to secede the southern part of Nigeria from the rest of the country, which importantly would include all of the oil producing regions.
Yeah.
So they launched
the Niger Delta.
Exactly, the Niger Delta. They launched an armed wing in December and started attacking police stations, election offices, and other institutions. They raided a prison and freed 1,800 inmates. And then in June, their leader was arrested and taken to the capital, Abuja, where he awaits trial. So this, going back to our conversation about hierarchies in some of these groups, leaves the group weakened, but also aggrieved. So they are using this arrest of their leader as motivation and, closely watching what the process looks like around his trial and treatment. Mm. And so there's a lot of uncertainty in the future of that movement.
Mm.
So that's in the south, the Niger Delta, as you mentioned. But if you go a bit west of there.
Hold on, we're still in the south. We're still in the south. I've actually been to the south. And so most people that go to Nigeria go to like Abuja because that's where the government offices are. They go to Lagos because that's where the commerce and the Nollywood and banking and the sort of heart of the economy is. I've actually been to a place called Port Harcourt, which is in the south. It's in the Niger Delta. It's sort of the epicenter of all of the oil companies have their operations there. Interestingly, as a total aside, it's also like mega churches lining both sides of the highway. Like apparently I was there actually doing research on like what the workforce of the future could look like in places like Nigeria, where it was a multi-country, multi-continent study. And I came away from Port Harcourt being like, you know, religion seems like a really booming industry. So like, let's not think of this as like just something that people do on Sundays, but like, could this actually be an engine of economic growth? So more on that, perhaps.
Put a Texas boy in Nigeria. He'll find all the oil and religion, mega churches.
I hadn't even thought about that. But in the South, I mean, one of the things, and I don't know, I haven't followed this recent story closely enough to know whether this is happening, but it's worth noting that in the South, especially in the Niger Delta, there are really sophisticated gangs that have made tons and tons of money out of kidnapping oil workers, which was sort of why we debated even going there ourselves. I mean, I'm a 6'3" white guy, like put a target on my back, and I certainly don't have any interest in getting kidnapped. But apparently it's big business for them. You know, that level of organization and arms, I'm sure there's, you know, these people are heavily armed. They have boats that they ride through the Delta, et cetera. They have, you know, camps where they keep prisoners and people that they've kidnapped. So I'd be surprised if that infrastructure that has already been in place for years, if not decades, is sort of tangentially related to this Indigenous Peoples of Biafra sort of Igbo movement.
And to your point, Shell has just announced that they are pulling out of all of their onshore operations in Nigeria, and they've been a major presence in the country through some pretty tough periods in their history.
Wow. I wonder how the Nigerian player on that show on Apple TV, Ted Lasso, would react to what's going on in Nigeria right now. Do you watch Ted Lasso?
Of course. Of course.
Yeah.
Sam.
Sam Abyssinia, right?
Yeah. He was an awesome storyline in season two. I assume you're through season two.
Yes.
Yeah. No spoilers on this show, but it's nice that we have a reference that we both get on this one.
I won the pop culture game today. I was the one who brought it up. Part of me wishes you hadn't seen it so I could like have some sort of one-upmanship, but nice. I'm glad you have seen it so that we could actually talk about Sam Abyssinia.
So we've been talking about the Niger Delta and we'll get to the gangs because that really is a nationwide problem as well. But if you go a bit west of that area to Lagos, which you mentioned is the commercial capital and is quite prosperous in many ways. They've got Nollywood and is a real cultural center. Three of the four tech unicorns in Africa are based there. And it's the largest metropolitan area in Africa as well. But there you've got another separatist group called the Yoruba. And they've also started taking up arms, incidentally. It's not clear that they're, you know, a threat on the scale of the jihadists or the Biafra group yet. But importantly, across both of those regions. So, you know, I'm sure that all of our listeners have a map of Nigeria in their head, so we can speak to this. But basically, Lagos and the Niger Delta sit on the coast, right? And they're on the coast of the Gulf of Guinea. And the Gulf of Guinea has basically taken over from the Gulf of Aden off Somalia as the biggest hotspot for piracy in the world over the last 5 to 10 years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so you've got a lot of that gang violence and organized criminal activity that you're talking about kind of enmeshed with this piracy activity, and you see it spilling over on shore.
Wow. I did not know that. I have a Lego story. Is now the time for my Lego story?
Do it, because we're about to start heading north.
Okay, good. So you mentioned Nollywood, which is the Nigerian Hollywood. And so as part of this same trip, we were thinking about what the future of work looks like in Nigeria. And so I don't even remember exactly how we pulled this off, but my fellow researcher and I, when we were in Lagos, so there's this island in Lagos, which is basically the concentration of wealth is not just in Lagos. It's like on this island, and that's where all the luxury hotels are, and that's where the studios are, and the whatever. So we were not staying in there, and we come over the bridge to the island and for lunch at this fancy hotel with Omotola Jalade Akinde, which if there is any Nigerian person listening, they would immediately know who that is, because she is one of the biggest Nollywood stars. She has, let me pull up her Instagram. She has how many followers? 5.3 million followers on Instagram. Wow. And is just a major influencer before influencers were cool.
That's even more than the News and Brews Instagram account, which everyone should follow.
I think that's even more than but just by a couple though. We ended up having lunch with her and a few fellow actors. One of the most fascinating things I've had, by the way, she's at Real Omo Sexy on Instagram for those that would like to look her up and follow her.
That explains why I couldn't get that handle.
which I recommend everyone do follow. She's an ambassador. I don't know if it's to the UN Refugee Agency or something. She's done a bunch of philanthropic work in addition to her acting. She's so famous, Mike, that again, if you talk to a Nigerian about you had lunch with Omotola, holy crap. And so that's my feather in my cap with regards to Nigeria. And on top of that, she was super nice and super smart. So
awesome. So you've got jihadists in the north, separatists and pirates and gangs in the south, and then basically all over the country, but headquartered in the northeast, you have the source of more killings this year than the jihadists or the separatists. And that is these criminal gangs. They're called bandits, colloquially.
Yeah.
And they basically will roll into town on motorbikes and steal everything of value in an entire village. So in agricultural areas, they'll come in and take all the livestock. They'll take people's livelihoods. They'll kidnap people. They'll kill people. And ultimately, the number of kidnappings in Nigeria has more than doubled in each of the last 2 years, has already exceeded 2,000 this year. And over 8,000 people are set to die in Nigeria's internal conflicts this year. And that's across government forces, militants, and civilians. Hmm. So underlying a lot of this is a long simmering cultural and ethnic conflict between herders and farmers, basically. So there's a group called the Fulani. That's a group of nomadic herders that have been in not just Nigeria, but sort of up and down the western part of Africa for hundreds and hundreds of years. And they are one of the largest nomadic cultures in the world that still remains. But climate change has brought drought and desertification to the northern part of the country to the extent that they have basically been pushed into direct conflict with farmers in central Nigeria. And this has been well documented in scholarly articles going back over the last 10 years or so. And so this conflict basically sits in the background and exacerbates some of the other security problems Nigeria is facing. So, farmers who have had their livelihoods destroyed in conflicts with herders are now more likely to become bandits. They don't have a whole lot of other options. The separatist groups in the south end up justifying some of their anti-government actions by saying they're basically trying to protect themselves from Fulani herders. And President Buhari actually is the son of a Fulani herder. So there's some subtext of kind of cultural conflict in those criticisms and those justifications.
Yeah, this has been happening in Nigeria for quite some time. And I think that it's one of probably two or three examples that people who want to connect climate change to conflict use. One frustrating part of this is that people are really quick to paint this as Muslim versus Christian. The same thing happened in Sudan, South Sudan, like, oh, the Muslims in the north, you know, persecuting the Christians in the south. And likewise, the Fulani herders are by and large Muslim, and the farmers in the south are by and large Christians. And so it's easy and really incomplete and lazy to paint this through religious terms, which it's, I have to say, it's not just people who don't understand the conflict that do this. There's actually people who should know better that are also doing this. So that's, I will step off my soapbox now.
No, it's an important soapbox, I think, to acknowledge, because we've talked about the expansiveness of the global war on terror as an organizing framework for how people have understood the world for the last 20 years. And I think it's just that it's such a distorting view to reduce something like this conflict to two religions in the same place, and just prevents anyone from thinking about constructive solutions.
Well, and GWAT, the Global War on Terror, was largely, terror was defined as groups that were terrorists that also happened to be Muslim, that sort of were using Islam and bastardizing Islam, et cetera. And so the Global War on Terror almost became the Global War on Islam. It's frustrating to me that we're still having these discussions about sort of Islam being this extremist religion. I think that there are lots of extremist groups that take advantage of Islam, perhaps more than other religions. I don't know the data, but we have not updated the definition of terrorism to include right-wing terrorism in the United States and Europe, and other kind of non-traditional sort of post 9/11, almost like overly personified, overly simplified versions of terrorism.
And I think in official capacities we have, right? If you look at the FBI's terrorist tracking, you know, it's quite comprehensive, but culturally, not at all. I mean, even with this murder of an MP in Britain a couple of weeks ago, which we haven't really talked about in detail, but they declared it, quote unquote, a terrorist act early on, which was basically code for saying the perpetrator was a Muslim.
Yeah.
And that's, it's not useful at this point, let alone being, you know, insensitive and risking, you know, a backlash against other innocent people who happen to be Muslims. I've been actually thinking, so this is like a total aside, and I'm just like hanging on desperately to your soapbox, I think, at this point, but I've been thinking a lot about the nature of terror since we pulled out of Afghanistan, really, and kind of began to close the book on this chapter. And terror is a really personal experience, right? There was a moment on September 11th when Americans and a lot of other people around the world collectively experienced a sense of terror because of a set of attacks. But it morphed and metastasized over the years and decades after that. And what really brought it home was actually a series of podcasts that The Daily put out over the last several weeks and over the last couple of months at this point. But they had some really excellent first-person narratives of what has been happening in Afghanistan. One with an Afghan military commander who talked about, you know, the U.S. soldiers asking some of their Afghan counterparts where they could get chicken, which led to the Afghan service members going and stealing by force chickens from local farmers who that may have been their only livelihood. That represented terror for those individuals being perpetrated by Afghan service members on behalf of Americans. Now that the Taliban are back, that does represent terror legitimately for a lot of people, especially young women who have been trying to go to school and able to do that and able to dream and now aren't. And there's just terror comes from so many places. And you see that in Nigeria as well, right? So we'll talk about the government's response to all of this in just a moment. But one part of what the government has been doing is launching airstrikes against these various armed groups. And The Economist did an interview with someone who had been kidnapped, who basically said, while I was being held hostage, which was a ransom kidnapping, not totally unlike what we talked about happening in Haiti, while I was being held hostage, my biggest fear was that the government would bomb the compound where I was.
Yeah.
And so that's a source of terror now as well.
really good points, and I'm glad you held on to that soapbox, because I think that's all really well put. I mean, I'd like to believe that we could have done over the past 20 years, we could have executed this war on terror, so-called, without creating terror. And I think that by and large, we've probably created more terror than we've experienced. Like, the sound of a drone overhead elicits incredible fear in the hearts of Somalis. And, you know, I think national security experts and et cetera would point to the fact that there hasn't been an attack on U.S. soil since 9/11 and therefore victory. But the cost of doing so is perhaps a much more insecure world that ultimately could have negative repercussions on the homeland. But also, you know, can't we just not make things worse overseas?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, as I mentioned, back to Nigeria, the government's response to all of this lack of security, really, up and down the country, has been ham-handed. The Economist describes it as, quote, a mixture of neglect and sporadic brutality, end quote. The army is 223,000 troops on paper, but there's a lot of speculation that it's a lot like the Afghan army, with a high number of ghost soldiers who basically exist for payroll purposes only. They have responded to a lot of the kidnapping activity with airstrikes, as I mentioned, which are indiscriminate and often counterproductive, especially when you're bombing your own country. And then it looks like a lot of their strategy has started to boil down to containment rather than control of the country. So the government controls the large population centers pretty closely, and they can escort convoys along any of the roads, but the small towns and villages are basically on their own. The roads are often clogged with gangs and bandits, and unsafe for anyone to travel. Meanwhile, the economy and other policies haven't really been helping. So GDP growth has been negative in two of the last 6 years and hasn't exceeded 2.7% since 2014. Even before the pandemic, 40% of the country lived on less than $2 a day. So that's 80 million people. And more than half were unemployed or underemployed. Food inflation, you know, we talk about inflation here and being concerned about 5.4%. Food inflation, right, in Nigeria is at 21%.
Yeah.
And part of this is policy related. So in 2019, they closed their land borders off to all trade in goods, hoping that they would spur local production. But in this environment where farms are being destroyed by herders and by bandits.
Yeah, it just led to shortages. Yeah.
Led to shortages, which means price spikes, and then you have 21% inflation in food all of a sudden.
Yeah. I'm not a major in economics, and I could have told them that that's a bad idea.
Right. Right. So a lot of this, as we see in many cases, again, going back to some of those consistencies that we tend to see everywhere we look, corruption is rife at the top of the economic ladder. The rich live in compounds, by and large, staffed by private security firms, which are booming in this environment. Politicians have actually been lobbying to increase domestic flights between Abuja and other provinces so they don't have to travel on the roads. There's sort of an ironic silver lining to all of this corruption, which is that you may wonder, how is the country going to stay together? You know, it's not a failed state, but certainly seems to have a lot of the ingredients. And the corruption, the unified stance of the elite across a number of groups, is actually one of the major unifying forces or reasons for the center to hold in the country. Because you basically have, you know, all of these elites with a stake in the status quo of how oil revenues are shared, how the economy is organized, the other systems that are in place. And so when there's a threat of secession or other systemic breakdowns, they end up being universally opposed by the elites, by those who hold the power, by those who control the communications and the media. And there's a lot of inertia there.
Yeah. Speaking of inertia, I mean, as you were talking about this, I just kept thinking this is all a recipe for popular discontent and protests. And so I wonder how, I mean, there have already been protests against police brutality recently in the past year or so. And I wonder how much protests against the elite capture that you talked about are in the future. And I think, you know, where this tends to bleed out over into the streets, whether it's Turkey or Lebanon or other places, is when it really starts affecting people's lives and livelihoods. So in Lebanon, for example, like there were protests in late 2019, ostensibly over like a, there was a new tax on WhatsApp that was being proposed or something, but it was like, that was the straw that broke the camel's back, that the camel's back was actually, you know, hurt much more by people were losing jobs. They were unable to afford bread. This is like been a borderline developed country. And now there's like, you know, food lines and, you know, people unable to kind of provide for their families. And so this sort of popular discontent, they were like, we don't know what the answer is, but we know that this is not it. And so I wonder how much of that is in Nigeria's future. Of course, the challenge is Nigeria is a huge place, as you mentioned. And so while there could be protests in Lagos, there, you know, Abuja is actually not a very big town. It's not a very populated town. It becomes a ghost town on the weekends because people go back to their villages. It's a bit like Brussels in that way. I don't know if you've ever been to Brussels, but like on the weekend, Brussels is like dead. I don't know what kind of nationwide protests would look like there, at least protests that were strong enough to make kind of national change, especially given all of the other challenges that you talked about.
Well, I think if you look at the violence that's happening across the country, whether it's the separatist groups in the Niger Delta or around Lagos or in the north with the gangs, there is this undercurrent of a loss of faith in the government and a discontent with the level of protection and service people are getting. So I do think you unfortunately are seeing a culture develop where it's not protest, but it's violence that is how that popular discontent gets expressed.
Yeah. No, I that's a really great point. Such a contributor to the fragility that obviously exists across that country. I will say I have really enjoyed the fact that in this main story that you're the one who's talking about all the ins and outs of conflict and violence, and I'm here talking about Nollywood and mega churches. It's nice. It's nice to have a role reversal.
We lean into our expertise on this show. It's good. Last angle, I think, on Nigeria that we wanted to talk about. And this actually came directly out of some listener feedback and some nudges that we got, is that against this backdrop of growing instability and some economic stagnation, Nigeria this week became the first African country to issue a central bank digital currency, which is called the e-Naira.
Their currency is called the Naira, so that's why it's the e-Naira, exactly. if that wasn't obvious.
The Central Bank Digital Currency, or CBDC, to use an acronym that I think you and I both had to look up when it was suggested that we talk about it.
I may or may not have Googled it.
is basically like Bitcoin or Ethereum. You know, it's a digital currency built on the blockchain, essentially executed as a series of digital contracts that can be verified by a decentralized network and settled almost instantaneously. But it is controlled by the central government. There is usually some form of identity verification, some form of, you know, anti-corruption safeguards that governments can take, but also then opens up users of this system to privacy violations, potentially by a government that has visibility into all the transactions, other security concerns. So Nigeria is an early mover in this. They follow the Bahamas, St. Kitts and Nevis, Antigua and Barbuda, St. Lucia, Grenada, and St. Vincent and Grenadines as the only countries so far to have issued CBDCs. The most anticipation is around China's, which is set to be issued next year, and they already have a number of banks on board. But this comes after Nigeria banned crypto exchanges, you know, of the Bitcoin or Ethereum variety earlier in the year. And President Buhari claims that this could boost GDP by $29 billion over 10 years, which amounts to about 0.5 percentage point of annual growth.
Yeah, I'll believe that when I see it. The banning Bitcoin and other types of crypto just reminds me of the like closing borders to other goods comment that was made earlier. It seems, you know.
Oh, that's interesting. I had a bit of a different reaction to that, which is,
what was your reaction?
In a country that is at risk of succumbing to widespread gang control, and where you have thousands of kidnappings each year that are conducted for the purpose of collecting ransom, I think there's a real risk in having like open crypto exchanges with total anonymity out there.
Especially since a lot of those gangs are younger people who are much tech savvier than the elites in Lagos and Abuja, who are by and large old men.
You know, this, again, is far from an expert take, but I don't hate this move from Nigeria to issue a centrally managed digital currency. It feels like the kind of thing that could, you know, open up economic activity to people who otherwise may struggle to get things like credit. It feels like the sort of thing that in countries that do have that are free from things like currency pegs and have the ability to exert control over their money supply could allow governments and central banks especially to be much more responsive to changes in economic conditions. I actually think it's really interesting. I'm interested to see where it goes.
Yeah, I think we should dig into it more on future episodes because I think there's going to be more and more examples of this. This is, you mentioned China, but in the African continent, there have been discussions. South Africa has been talking about this for a while, and there's just been kind of regulatory and tying into the international banking system questions that are really outstanding still on this. So I don't know enough about it. So I think we should go down some rabbit holes and revisit it on a future episode.
Yeah, I did. I did talk to a Fed watcher who confirmed that this is not coming to the U.S. anytime soon. I think we've still got a couple of years till the Fed even gets their real-time rails in place. So
no,
we'll bide our time.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure if this is going to fix all of Nigeria's woes, but I do think that here on News and Brews, we did fix a lot of things today. And we'll see everyone next week.
Pleasure as always. Thanks, everyone. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabake. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Tuesday, October 26, 2021 at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.